one thing I want to show you. Can you read that?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that arrived yesterday. Quite good timing. You had, oh, I should say for the listeners, Jonathan Leighton's More Alive and Less Lonely on Books and Writers. You hadn't mentioned that you'd done a nonfiction book. So
I buried the lead. Well, that one's sort of it's an outlier, and it was not prepared by me. It's not like Ecstasy of Influence or Disappointment Artist, which were, you know, conceived and edited into their shape by me. It was this other writer, Christopher Boucher, who assembled these stray pieces and had the gave the book its structure and, well, everything, the title and the section titles and so forth. So all I did was all I did was write the book. I didn't do anything else.
Well, I brought it up besides to plug it for you because of on the very second piece, footnote on Sylvie Seelig, you know what the first line is?
What's the first line?
I'm not a writer who hides.
Well,
yeah, it seemed very synchronicitous anyway.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, I understood the context you used it in there, and well, I think I did, and of course my experience of you was of a writer who didn't hide, as in you were responsive and very open. So,
but maybe I'm a writer who hides behind not hiding.
Yeah.
When you discover you're no good at conventional hiding, not hiding is the best mask left. It's the second best mask.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I've written about my brother in that regard, how he appeared. He created a mask of transparency, and I do wonder that about myself also. We can only reveal the things that we're actually conscious of anyway.
You know, the poet and visual artist Joe Brainard?
No.
He was sort of a late part, not one of the originating generation, but a next to come along member of, you know, what's called sort of the New York school in poetry, I think. And so associated with, you know, John Ashbery and Kenneth Koch and James Schuyler and Eileen Miles came along a little later, which is to say it's often a gay or bisexual milieu. Anyway, he was a very charming, apparently undefended figure whose most famous book is one called I Remember, which is about his coming of age, and it's just a series of assertions of things he remembers. Every sentence begins, every paragraph and every sentence begins, I remember, I remember. And he just offers seemingly processed, unfiltered recollections and lets you assemble him from them.
Hmm.
And I, it's always a book, it's a book that's very disarmingly charming, and the first response you have to it is to think, oh, I should be more honest or more direct. Why am I complicating things or disguising things? And, you know, he's made himself so available and it seems so appealing. And then I taught it once to my students, and the more I bore down on it, the more I saw it as an extremely elaborate game of substitution. If I offer you this, you won't even wonder about this other thing. You know, if I seem to be giving you so much undisguised material, it makes the fact that I'm very well disguised behind it seem unlikely. You won't even ask whether there's something I'm not telling you.
It's
bargaining. The disclosures are bargaining against the undisclosures.
Right. So yeah, that's similar but not exactly the same to a line that my brother used in his memoir, which he stole from Quentin Crisp, which is something like, the things that can't be concealed should be
brandished or
brandished with pride or something like that. Yeah. It's sort of getting right to the crux of what I wanted to talk to you about today, which means that all my notes go out the window, but that's okay. Maybe I can go back to them. But which is the whole question of what's fiction and non-fiction and the line between the two, and if there is one, and if there is, is it a moving one, and can we ourselves be conscious of it? So, I mean, for this example you just brought up, do you think that that writer, how conscious do you think he was of doing that?
Of designing himself a safe hiding place?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't think he was probably, I don't think it was the foreground. I don't think it was the explicit task, you know, let me configure a false revelation to hide behind. I think he was very excited to tell what he thought he, you know, I mean, it was fixed up for him, of course, with gay identity and confession of discovery of his own sexuality is foregrounded in the book. Childhood longing that seemed to him socially condemned. But there's also the, you know, something I think you'll identify with, that I was just reading that long piece you'd written about the response to the Blood Poets and how you've foregrounded the ache for fame, the rage for fame. And Brainerd was trying to announce himself as well. He's trying to become visible, but he was also trying to make a distinctive persona. And so, you know, we could mix up the third polarity. If there's wanting to be known and wanting to be hidden, you know, wanting to be Superman but also wanting to be Clark Kent, there's also wanting to be celebrated or seen as unique versus wanting to connect and be taken for normal or blend in or be accepted. And I, you know, I don't know. I think Brainerd was probably being as honest as he could be. And I think he probably backed into the problem of the disguises and the bargains, one form of transparency against other, you know, opacities, other disguises and hiding places. It doesn't feel like the book is in bad faith. But it feels gestural. After a certain point, you realize this honesty is also a performance of honesty.
Right. Because this process that we're touching on now was mapped in Seen and Not Seen. I mean, that was kind of the core of Seen and Not Seen, was and in some way intersecting with reading your work and dialogue with your work, that led me to go back to my own work and have a dialogue with my previous work with the Blood Poets, and recognize the ways in which I had been concealing things from myself by making this posture or this pose of, and I've been rereading some of the Blood Poets very recently, and I find it quite almost painful. Some of it just seems really very shallow. And that also coincided with Prisoner Infinity, which I don't think you've read, but that was looking at Whitley Strieber's work and recognizing the ways in which he had created this, what I call the crucial fiction, out of his experiences, turned it into a narrative. With the fervent, sincere belief that he was just reporting something, but essentially he was assembling this, tempted to say, a fortress of solitude. I think there is an overlap there, like this edifice in which he could be the Wizard of Oz and feel as though he was actually sharing something with the world and relate to the world, but through that constructed identity.
That's very persuasive. And I did read enough of your Whitley Strieber book to get some of the sense of that. I looked at it. I didn't read it carefully and exhaustively because you weren't writing about me. That was a joke.
Beware of what you wish for.
But you know what's interesting is that I've also quite by chance I'd gone down a kind of a Whitley Strieber rabbit hole many years before, involuntarily, because of being a sounding board for Richard Grossinger, who was also interested in the traumatic and Jungian aspects of Strieber's material and the way in which it spoke figuratively. And so it reminded me of that project, which had surprised me at the time, because I thought Strieber had sort of disqualified himself from my interest before I even had any.
Right. Well, there's a line in one of the essays in here, I don't remember which it was now, but I checked the date. It was from 2000, in which you talk about sexual abuse morphing into alien abduction and back again.
Oh, yeah.
So that was quite surprising.
There it is.
Yeah, exactly that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a trace paraphrase of Richard's thinking, probably, there. Mm.
Right, so more overlaps there than I was aware of then, because I felt that Prison Infinity was probably just a little too far from your digging patch.
Yeah, but not really. I mean, if you look at, in a way, some of almost the point of origin for my instinct to sort of split the difference between verifiable, fantastic devices and psychological, allegorical imagery, you know, it, which reaches its culmination in the, you know, multiple interpretability of the ring in Fortress of Solitude. I mean, that's the simplest and most absolute version of it. But that goes back to my childhood excitement about the kinds of dual fantastical, you know, the rival interpretability of a story like Charlotte Gilman Perkins' The Yellow Wallpaper or Henry James' Turn of the Screw, or you know, a couple of his others, the ghost stories, The Jolly Corner, that the fantastical occurrence as both a story of the fantastic and a psychological or emotional or archetypal allegory. You know, Twilight Zone, my interest in Rod Serling, my preference for that kind of science fiction where there was always this possibility that it could all be claimed as a, you know, super developed journey through a landscape of the psyche.
Mm-hmm.
When that really, that lays a ground for being at least tempted to be interested in something like Strieber's conflation of childhood sexual abuse and alien abduction. But I always found Strieber embarrassing in a way that kept me from going there and actually sampling it. But that also, truthfully, has to do with something that I've navigated as an area of resistance unsuccessfully, which is that, as with the Western, while I've gotten over my own quarantine or snobbery or apprehension about the genre as a set of film operations, you know, I mean, I can exalt Peckinpah and John Ford and you know, a whole lot of other stuff, Bud Boedeker, and I don't really read Westerns unless they're, you know, literary. And with horror, I've never been able to read horror. So Whitley Strieber went into this category along with Stephen King and Peter Straub and some other writers who I thought might be interesting to me if I could get around it, but I never could. I could read contemporary crime writing and I could read contemporary science fiction, but the last horror writer that feels like a real writer to me in a way is Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, even, you know, I mean, there are a couple of small dabblings with William Hope Hodgson, The Nightland, and you know, and Lovecraft. I've read a bit of Lovecraft, but there's something about it that still I'm still blocked against. And Strieber was always seemed like a kind of a B level, you know. If I wasn't going to read Stephen King and Peter Straub, why would I be trying to figure out what we were thinking about Whitley Strieber?
Well, yeah, well, of course, Strieber, I mean, what makes him of relevance and how I could write a whole book about him is he made this transition from horror fiction to horror nonfiction in his own mind, at least. And I'd say I pretty much show in Prisoner Infinity there's definitely something there, whether there's a true supernatural or non-physical or non-human element, there's certainly a non-ordinary reality element, even if it's the non-ordinary reality of MK Ultra and, you know, psychological operations.
Which reminds me, of course, that one of the other great exemplars of this area of rival interpretability narratives that, you know, is that film Jacob's Ladder, which must compel you.
It does, and, yeah. I find it very compelling. Yeah.
You know, and has its archetypal source in that occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge,
Ambrose Bierce.
Ambrose Bierce story, exactly. Yeah. I also, you know, I like the way in which something like Flann O'Brien's The Third Policeman enters into this realm. Is, you know, so the allegory of the experience of death as a landscape or a, you know, a kind of bardo, involuntary amnesiac bardo. It's like Philip K. Dick's Ubik or Flann O'Brien's Third Policeman. I'm trying to think of other things that take that for the beer story and Jacob's Ladder kind of go in a very specific kit of death as landscapes, you know.
Right. Well, that the subject of amnesia, of course, you bring up In various of your essays, you wrote the introduction to the book about of amnesia, and this is a kind of as a subgenre, and it's actually the novel that I mentioned last time that I attempted to write, partly as an experiment and partly as this ongoing attempt I have to graduate, as I see it, to the realm of fiction writer. It has amnesia as a central element because of my interest in MKUltra and what it would be like to be dissociative identity disorder in this very engineered way where one actually has these different alters that are taking over at different times, how one might actually experience that if one became semi-cognizant of it in terms of missing time, for example. I think that this is, I mean, to bring it back to the largest subject, which was partly about fiction and non-fiction and your antipathy for Strieber or your embarrassment with Strieber, it occurred to me, because, you know, as I said last time, the strongest intersection between your and my perspectives, I think, is represented or embodied by Philip K. Dick's work. Like, I mean, I consider myself more paranoid even than Philip K. Dick. I'm trying to be objectively speaking there. I think that many of the things I believe and write about, you know, are as extreme as the things Dick wrote about. And one of the interesting parallels occurs to me with Dick is that I'm always trying to somehow graduate to nonfiction for various reasons, which I won't go into, whereas he kind of made the transition the opposite way. He gradually transitioned from being a fiction writer to a non-fiction writer with the exegesis, and even Vallis was essentially, he just tried to novelize his experiences, no?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's true that his passage is very Strieber-like, but he's also, he's a metaphysician. So rather than it being all about intimate trauma, it's about intimating that the world has been damaged and that he happened to just be a kind of canary in the coal mine. So he begins to reinterpret his own fiction as nonfiction in the cause of a collective experience. I mean, in a way, Strieber seems, and this is fatuous because I haven't read him, but there's something self-indulgent. It's almost petulant, like not enough people were impressed with my depictions of reality when I tried to make them universal and metaphoric and evocative. So now I'm going to withdraw into claiming them as actually injury and see if I can get the attention that I seek. Whereas Dick seems quite selfless in a way. He's tried to make his visions compelling to us, and he did in the 60s. And then in the 70s, he starts to feel that they might be urgent warnings to everyone, that it's his job to interpret, but that he's still caught up in a collective and selfless endeavor in some way that more resembles the art, the artist's relation to the other, whereas Strieber's operation seems to me to decline the artist's relation to the other, and instead, I mean, he really is an emblematic figure of claiming, you know, injury that no one else can even fathom or imagine as his, you know, his credential.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be seen as a kind of precursor to a, you know, critique of the injury politics that arranges itself only around trauma and grievance.
Well, added to which is the credential of it was done to me by non-human beings, therefore I am marked as a spokesperson for non-human contact with another reality. So he has elevated himself to the role of prophet in that regard and convinced a whole little subcult. So in that sense, I mean, he's a comparison to Dick as a negative comparison, I would agree. And Dick was what we might call tentatively a genuine artist, a genuine explorer of the psyche, whereas Strieber has doubled down through trauma and become a spokesperson of a crucial fiction, I'd say, or of a defense, a defensive narrative.
Jason, hold on just a moment. I've got an amusing distraction coming our way, which is that they're having an earthquake drill on campus in a couple of minutes. And I think I can safely ignore it if I turn off the lights in my office. So I'm going to do that. They won't know I'm here. Well, I'm supposed to evacuate the building, but I'm going to non-evacuate and talk to you instead.
So Dickian.
The doors are substantial here, and in the clatter of everyone leaving the building, they probably, if my lights are off, they probably won't know that I'm disobeying the imaginary earthquake and staying inside that.
Okay, and if a real earthquake comes and this is your final moments, then at least we have it on record.
When I was a much younger man, I went to the university. I tried super hard to understand till I had a big epiphany. I cried, none of you people can really be trusted. You're not searching for enlightenment. All of you people are just running a hustle to try to pay the rent. And then a genial professor of history took my arm and he took me aside. He said, I guess you've seen through the mystery. You must be very clever, he lied. But did it ever occur to you, son, in your search for the truth to be spilled, If I ever really thought that you could hurt this institution, I would pay someone to have you killed. Because don't you know it's nothing personal? You seem like a reasonable man. If you fuck with my hustle, I will get you if I can. I went out into the world to start perusing it with my new hustle glasses on. Suddenly, a whole lot of confusing shit had a clear explanation. I saw a hustle there, a hustle here. Everybody seemed to have at least one. But I soon found out the people that you really got to fear are the ones who don't know they've got a hustle going on. Don't you know it's nothing?
So yeah, with Dick, one of the things that impressed me about Dick that I consider relevant here is that he made this sort of half-assed attempt in that famous speech, I think it was in Paris, where he tried to actually introduce his vision of reality as a matrix, and he bungled it so poorly. Yeah. Nobody understood what he was talking about. And
you know, well, I do also think though that his strategic error, if you can even speak of him on the level of strategy, because he was so ingenuous, but the way he offended in France was by introducing Christianity. It wasn't the literal commitment to metaphysics or a revised cosmology, where he insisted that he was speaking non-figuratively about the universe, that really put the crowd against him. I believe it was his introduction of Christ that put the crowd against him, because they didn't have access to his radical visionary framework for understanding religion. They had a very European traditional bourgeois sense that Catholicism and a belief in Christ was a kind of only a conventional and disappointing, failure to be an artist or visionary, whereas Dick was living out here on the radical edge, where there was such a thing as a Jesus freak, which is what he'd become. Mm-hmm. You know, especially in that period, there was access to a visionary Christian, you know, Gnostic conversation that. He didn't prepare the French for that aspect of his new message.
Right. Yeah. Well, I hadn't factored that in, but I think it's still part and parcel of what I picked up from it, was that his heart wasn't really in it when it came to being a prophet. He really was introspective.
Yeah. Well, also his. Yeah, I think that's true. That he was so utterly anti-authoritarian. His persona, his charisma, was bound up in self-contradicting, self-effacing humor, and puncturing certainties. So he wasn't a good vehicle for transmitting any even temporary propositional certainties. Yeah, he was a terrible prophet, because what I think he opted for in trying to persuade was a kind of droning scholasticism. He doggedly wrote down a kind of it was like a boring college dissertation or something about his beliefs, but his charisma had fled the area at that moment.
Hmm. Which I say is to his credit, I think. I think the Dick's meanings they've filtered through the culture, and they've been co-opted and undermined and all the rest of it, inevitably, as happens. But they've still, I think, because they were so partially formed and the exegesis wasn't even published, he was really writing it for himself, so it was almost like it was quarantined and retained some sort of pristine quality via that, and the way it's filtered through, I think he's quite exceptional in this regard, because yes, he's been co-opted by the culture and he's become this brand now with the movies and whatnot, but there still remains the sort of the pure Dick, which is incomprehensible to most people. I don't know how many people bought the exegesis, but I bet only 1% of them read it, you know.
Well, what is it to even read it? I don't know if I've ever read it, you know.
Your eyes have passed over it, I presume.
Yeah, I mean, I edited it and tried to manage it and make it readable as well as I could, but it's in a sense it's not written to be read. It's written to be to be written.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to use language as a scalpel to tear open a curtain. And it's a series of slash marks on the curtain.
Hmm.
And you can use it to peer through, but it's not ordinary reading.
So that's where I felt we were going to begin with this conversation, was the question of when a person writes, when a writer writes, the extent to which they're being honest seems as though it can't be gauged by how much they're trying to be honest, because the conscious mind, you know, has all of these subterfuges, but rather to the extent to which they are able to use writing to expose themselves to themselves. In mm-hmm. other words, that they discover, they tear that veil.
Yeah.
Or they penetrate the membrane of their own defense fictions. They end up undermining their own ego structures and whatnot, and might have a very disoriented and uncomfortable experience in the process of writing. It might also be satisfying, but at the end of it, they have the feeling is that they have discovered something about themselves in the process of trying to communicate, perhaps something else.
Right. Right. Yeah, well, you know, language is, I mean, I think I wrote about this some in the introduction to the Ecstasy of Influence, that language is a treacherous tool. Because it's infiltrated into consciousness at the level of fantasy. It's making stories by its nature. Every sentence is a kind of story, and so you can't use it to make photographs of anything. You can use it to make lots of little tiny piles of stories that add up to bigger stories that, you know, at a certain resolution can look like a photograph of something if you stand at the right distance, if you don't stand so close that you see the pixels of language.
Hmm.
Mostly you're going to fail it, even at that even the photograph will have, you know, at one resolution it'll look mostly right, but this area over here will look wrong because the the fantasy story that language wants to tell, and your own fascination with that fantasy story will have made you choose to, you know, do something different over there. And anyway, you're mixed up in the picture too. Your preferences and your inclinations, your amusements and your apprehensions are another story the language wants to tell. Every attempt to write a novel is, you know, I mean, there's this Godard quote that I like, which is every film is whatever else it is, it's a documentary of a portion of the lives of the actors. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, if you make a film with John Paul Belmondo, who's a professional actor who's playing a gangster in Breathless for you, you've also made accidentally a documentary about 3 weeks in the life of Jean-Pierre Belmondo. Mm-hmm. Jean-Paul Belmondo, right? And that's one of the only things, in fact, you can be certain that you've made. So I would say that a novel is a comparable thing. Even as it's a fiction designed to tell you something about reality, it's also an accidental documentary, or in this case, not documentary, but journal of years worth of daily sentence making on the part of an individual author who's sitting down, slightly different, slightly anxious, slightly hungry, slightly sad, and adding sentences to this compilation. So it's one of the only things you can be sure the novel is a, you know, 2 or 3 year journal of a period of the life of its author.
Right. A document, yeah. So it's referring, as you say, to the state with digestion and the whatever's going on internally with the writer, even though he's not writing about any of that. That is informing the actual document itself.
Well, and then one of the things that happens if you write a few of these things is that if you're attentive, you become conscious of that layer, and then maybe interested in it, which is an opportunity that is also treacherous. You know, I mean, right. So the truism about the first person narrator who begins in a way with The Great Gatsby is that, you know, The Great Gatsby is the book where the Somerset Maugham presumption that there can be a first person narrator who's only telling a story but isn't in it. You know, who says, I heard this wonderful story, or I watched these fascinating people and I'm going to tell you about them, and you won't become actually more interested in the narrator than in the people. Mm-hmm. That ends with Gatsby, where everyone understands that in a way the journey of the narrator is the secret reality that predominates in that novel, that his experience, his sensibility is the real you know. And then after that you get the 20th century. In many ways the history of the novel becomes the history of the unreliable narrator. I mean, almost all of the important modernist innovations, whether they're written in the first person or not, are about the language, the voice, the narration becoming something other than a window pane, right? Virginia Woolf, Beckett, James Joyce, you know, Nabokov, and so forth. And so that's really only one level of understanding. But the next is, oh, you know, no matter what strategies, whether I, you know, reassert a kind of pre-modernist 18th century, 19th century novelistic license to be omniscient and write like Balzac or Dickens, or whether I go into some sort of experimental mode, or whether I write autofiction. This is currently fashionable thought that you can sort of be honest inside fiction in some new way. Mm-hmm. It's beautifully naive. It's associated with many extremely compelling works, but the presumptions that there's this sort of breakthrough into honesty in fiction is almost pathetic in its kind of the gullibility. The fact is, at some level, if you start writing these things, you notice that you're doing a documentary of your own daily practice of adding sentences to a giant meaningless pile of sentences and trying to make it impressive to someone else. And then that becomes an intriguing you know, feature, not a bug, if you're lucky. Or it can be the bug that dissolves the whole project and makes it impossible to sustain.
Mm. Yeah, well, I've had both experiences for sure, and they can be almost indistinguishable. So, very appropriate example for you and I, that the How Am I Not Myself piece, which is how I introduced myself to you, mm-hmm. the piece about Philip K. Dick, that actually, I've just gone back to it, because that the book I was working on that was a chapter on in became unraveled after I wrote the piece on Dick. And reading, mm-hmm. rereading that piece, what I feel happened during that piece was the thing that I think it was a turning point for me, because that led to Seen and Not Seen via my connection to you. And I think I found my voice as a writer, at least for now anyway. Maybe I'll mm-hmm. find a deeper voice still, but through writing about Dick. And I think that the reason that happened, I mean, it would have to do with an affinity for Dick that I was discovering. But what happened while writing How Am I Not Myself was the very thing that piece was about began to happen. As in, mm-hmm. I was writing about how Dick got possessed by his fiction, or how his unconscious spilled out through his fiction and then turned into his life. Mm-hmm. And I was experiencing the same thing happening to me while I was writing about Dick. So it was like I was losing the boundary between myself and Dick, and thereby the boundary between my unconscious and conscious mind, and between what I was writing on the page and what was actually happening by the act of writing it. So it was like this vanishing wormhole, what have you.
Yeah.
In which the thing happened, you know? And potentially that well, I see the potential there is like superimposed circles, I guess. If they're lying closely, then the reader can pass through that, because if I'm having this experience in the moment of writing it, then that's on the page, and then the reader will have the same experience in the moment of reading it, presumably seeing themselves in the writer, right. And then it seems as though something happens that, well, there are no words for.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, the words have been the medium for
something.
Yeah,
I think this is a nice description of a kind of objective desire for the novelist is to have the problems match the solutions occur at the same in the same range, mm-hmm. and that's also to say have the literal material and the figurative material aligned so closely that they become fused together. You know, I mean, I think you could see this attained in certain exemplary cases like Kafka's The Castle or Moby Dick. You know, I mean, it's almost, you could almost say the standard is that even the title should fuse the literal and the figurative, you know, and the thematic desires of the author to transmit meaning, all should be aligned so totally that, you know, your central metaphor and your central subject and your preoccupation at the micro and the macro level, and your the ineluctable or irreconcilable part of your desire to have written something bigger than yourself or attain something other than yourself are all aligned. And you know, so it with Kafka's The Castle or Moby Dick, in both cases the frustrated desire to reach to Melville's term is to strike through the mask, right. Comes back to masks,
mm-hmm.
You know, and to confront the whiteness of the whale, mm-hmm. Or Kafka's desire to attain the castle, you know, those are sort of ultimate novelistic gestures, because they encode the record of their own search as the primary occupation of the book.
But also undermining themselves.
Yes. Well, of course, and Kafka couldn't finish the castle. Right. He abandoned it and moved on.
Yeah.
So
one of the ways that this has been concretizing, maybe that's a regrettable thing, I don't know, but becoming into form, more conscious form, is that Dick to me represents, well, he is literally dead, but he also represents the non-consensual reality, which is one of its literal sort of manifestations, is the other side, the realm of the dead. And of course he had this preoccupation, am I alive or am I dead kind of thing, am I now or am I then, and so that it's helping me, I think, to reformulate my drive to reach a larger audience, which is just so, I mean, I can't, whatever, it's so internalized, I can't extract it, you know, it's just part of my drive to write. There's something in there that wants to communicate, and the world is an obvious receptacle. So there's this kind of idea that's partially false but partially true, that reaching more people is having, you know, more of an impact and being more effective. But the correlative that I've been discovering through Dick and exploring him, and not only, is that there's an inner world that I'm trying to reach, which corresponds with the world of the dead. And I'm actually able to communicate with that inner world. And of course, I don't get applause and I don't get any money in my bank account. You know, it's intangible, the results. So, but do you have a sense of that when you write, that you have an invisible audience?
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, and you know, I work by a kind of, you know, having attained some this level of business that piles up around a new book coming out, which I'm right at the doorstep of that right now. Seems to me a total obstacle to writing towards that invisible connection. And the way I allegorize this for myself is very lazy, but it also extends from something very native in me, which is that I don't like new books. I like used books. And so they only have to suffer through this period of being new for a while. I have to push them through it in order to get them into out of print status on used bookshelves where they can be discovered for their proper use, the way I discovered Philip K. Dick, and many others as a teenager, and that they're actually useless in this garbage stratum of the new. That's just a survival period for them where they have to get shoved through this garbage realm into grace, and grace is out of print and discovered by someone who doesn't know my name, because the title is peculiar or arresting in some way, or because some other teenager said, you've got to read this thing to you know, to the recipient.
So that has nothing to do with posterity then?
No, it's not posterity at all. It's about this, like you say, this invisible quality of connection.
So could you even extend that to the books themselves completely disappearing, but somehow having sowed a seed in the psyches of readers who pass that on? Maybe they don't even refer to the book, but some invisible, intangible element.
Yeah. I mean, the detachment of, I mean, this goes back to the ecstasy of influence, to the idea that, you know, I mean, forget posterity, even just having anyone ever read your book while you're alive or dead is such an improbable situation. And one of the only things to want from it is that it would dissolve into some archetype that would be useful precisely because it's detached from its point of origin. There's a sentence from The Fortress of Solitude, what age is the black boy when he learns he's scary, which has gotten taken up slightly, but taken up by the Black Lives Matter movement. And I actually saw a photograph someone sent me of someone marching with those words on a sign in a Black Lives Matter protest. And without their, without some kind of obviously attribution, and no attribution was needed, because the sentence was just meaning itself, meaning something about me or my book. And it seemed to me a very magical result, you know,
A leader comes along, promising a great big change. He seems so optimistic, he can't be wrong with his sunny, sunny ways. But before you wish him good luck with your career, please get him to explain exactly whose hustle shall be fucked with here, and whose hustle shall remain unchanged. Are you ready to fuck with the great hustling powers? That is the changing test, and if so, maybe they are going to beat you with flowers. But you better get yourself a little Kevlar vest. Don't you know it's not me?
Is that like you've been I'm reluctant to flatten it out to us because there's something quite magical about it, but I will anyway, like being a mouthpiece for a collective experience. So you've articulated something that,
yes, well, this is recursive in my case, because there are actually only two quotes of mine that circulate. If you look at Twitter, there are only two quotes of mine that really move the way quotes move through the, you know, ether psyche of the internet, in the sense that people somehow hear them and think that they're meaningful words. And, you know, they're not just bragging that they read something of mine, but they're really and one is this: what age is a black boy when he learns he's scary, which comes from The Fortress of Solitude. The other one is a sentence from the Ecstasy of Influence collage essay, and the sentence is, inspiration could be called inhaling the act, or inhaling the memory of an act never experienced, which I didn't say or write, and I never would have originated that sentence. It comes from the composer Ned Roram, but I appropriated it and put it in my piece, and so it circulates on the internet attributed to me. Instead of its author. And it's literally a kind of a, it's like an M.C. Escher drawing, because inspiration could be called inhaling the memory of an act never experienced. Well, I never experienced the act of writing that sentence.
Yeah, you inhaled it, right. And someone took it for your inspiration. Yeah.
Not only that, but Ned Roram, I think, dislikes me distinctly, because we were introduced once, and he had read something I'd written in the New York Times about Bob Dylan being a kind of a genius on the order of, you know, outside time and space on the order of William Blake. And he thought this was so, as a composer, Ned Roram is a contemporary American avant-garde composer, he found the idea that, he finds Dylan's musicality so laughably inept that I would claim him for this pantheon, you know, where only figures like William Blake or Shakespeare occupy it, to be so risible that I was a contemptible figure. And so poor Ned Roram has to see his inspiration as could be called inhaling the act of a memory ever experienced, attributed to me now. Yeah. So it's an inadvertent passive-aggressive gesture as well.
Yeah, you've been karmically spliced forever after in the afterlife.
We're karmically spliced, exactly. Yeah. I'm, you know, it's like it's like Philip K. Dick had to look at his arm, and it was Richard Nixon's arm attached to his body.
Right. The collective, the body of Antichrist.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, there's a lot there. So it's like something is playing out in the collective again. There's these different nodes. And so I wonder there, I mean, do you think that your desire to incorporate Dylan into the pantheon of the greats is only partially a desire to raise up Dylan and also partially a desire just to explode the whole pantheon?
Well,
because you know, once you have gate crashes at the party, that's it.
Well, you know, I think that it's very hard to place a meaningful bet on actual posterity, which is a very tiny raft floating on a great dark sea. I mean, I don't know that very many of my students have necessarily, you know, had an important encounter with a poem by William Blake. So what's even William Blake's status worth?
Well, yes, exactly.
But I think if I were to make a bet on let's say someone who was alive at the same time as you and I, it would be Bob Dylan.
But what is posterity? Sorry to cut you off there, but I mean, yeah, in the context of eternity, it's all the same.
It's such a stupid occupation. It's so pointless. Yeah.
So what I thought was maybe something vital there is this whole idea of the super genius, which, you know, I'm infected by too, but I'm very much trying to extract it because that's what drives my own desire to, you know, to enter Valhalla, and I see it as an unhealthy and a neurotic drive in myself, whether because it's unrealistic or whether because it's unrealistic. I mean, either way, there's two kinds of unrealistic there, right? It's unattainable or it's not worth attaining, but either way. And it seems to go against this other sense that we share, that we were just sharing, which is that it's not about the work, much less the person doing the work. It's about the transmission and the reception and how it informs, how it articulates, how it enhances the whole collective experience of itself.
Yeah. Yeah, the participation. I mean, last night I was listening to a very impressive on-stage conversation with a writer visiting our college, Mohsin Hamid, and he was talking about the hunger, the appetite for transcendent, revelatory forms of connection in human life, and that the literary enterprise was maybe, you know, the best hope for a universal language, that you know, religions were balkanizing and becoming more and more contained in their own, you know, that, I mean, he's from Pakistan, and he was saying, you know, the only voices of total collective reverence are, like, you know, Sufi poets from several centuries ago, whose expressions of their attempts to describe love and transcendence still compel tens of thousands of people to visit shrines devoted to their memory every year, you know, sort of take that New York Times bestseller list.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, it's how utterly foolish it was to imagine as a writer that some sort of individual contest to become as important to the human story as that, but that the collective enterprise that you could humble yourself to be a participant in as a writer, which you and I are participating in by having this conversation between two writers, is equal to the task. It's the entirety of it that everyone that stands some chance, however small, of satisfying the desperate collective hunger in the human story for something that speaks to our need for transcendence and you know, a transubstantiating experience between different types of human kind across time and space and culture and difference. And so when you think of it in those terms, you know, you're in the right ballpark, at least.
Yeah, well, that's the most tangible result of my writing, is that I've made living human connections to other souls through it.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily independent of it being published, because sometimes getting published certainly helped, but certainly independent of hitting the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and this is an area. It's funny because you in your piece, which I like just now on Feral Detective, you muse on how I might be in some way now triangulating against the onset of Edward Norton's film, that becoming part of that frontline entertainment industry, you know, complex is something that I have to find some urgent position toward. And I mean, I guess it's probably true. It's an interesting proposition for me that I should have to. I haven't really taken it on as an assignment. But what it reminds me of at this moment is, in what you're saying, is the kind of comical sense in which unmade artworks have created human meaning in my life. That, you know, when people ask me whether I'm very disappointed about all the films that weren't made, because it's been almost exclusively the situation that the books are optioned and developed and not made. And I mean, apart from the easy joke, which is I often collect a sum of money for the privilege of having them not make a movie, and that has kept the wolf from the door. It has enabled me to keep writing. But there's something else that almost invariably occurs, which is that I get to know these very interesting and eccentric and compelling humans who are trying to make the thing and failing, right. And form relationships that have changed my life. You know, in some cases, they're recursively interesting ones, like my very, very deep and lasting friendship with Hampton Fancher, who wrote Blade Runner and then tried and failed to make Gun with Occasional Music into a film. Hmm. And in other cases, they're obvious and relevant. You know, I've gotten to know David Cronenberg a bit, and that's deepened my sense of his artwork and its reach into me and its influence on me, but also enabled me to simply share human sympathies with a person I wouldn't have otherwise, and see him not as an impassive fixture. You know, maybe it's comparable to the way I've become human to you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so not only successful or even existing artworks can connect human beings, but failed and non-existing artworks, in this case, are connecting human beings. That simply by nominating yourself into the space of our interest in one another's imaginative acts, you know, collaboratively. Now, you know, I'm not saying that these filmmakers who failed to make my movies weren't also selfish or hoping to collect a check or become famous, or you know maybe that 10 years from now Edward Norton is seen more as the author of Motherless Brooklyn as a cultural text than I am, and he will have usurped me as the author of Motherless Brooklyn. But it doesn't really matter, you know. I mean, I'll learn what having an actual extant movie does to my psyche, but having these non-existent movies has actually been incredibly human and involving experience for me. So, you know, and that's in a realm all junked up with agents and lawyers and money, and yet it nevertheless occurs.
Hmm.
Let alone what occurs, you know, when I commune with my aspiring students, or express my solidarity with you, or when you hand your manuscript to some other person who you admire. And you know, the transactional, you know, we're so encouraged by the twin goblins of romanticism and capitalism to see the artist as this isolated unit. But so we're endlessly undervaluing the intertextual, communal, transactional, social nature of the experience, even where it doesn't, you know, hit the New York Times bestseller list. A thing I've incidentally only ever done once for 1 week, you know, but I get to be called a New York Times bestselling author for the rest of my life because of that 1 week at position number 15. It's a kind of a comedy, right? But that's not where the action is. That's why I think about that, you know, garbage realm that the books have to be pushed past into the hands of, into the, you know, and that's why, ironically, even hiding nested within the garbage realm and within a very exhausting mode of existence for me, which I'm about to undertake or undergo or endure, which is book tour, there's something very sublime that will occur. Almost, it's guaranteed to occur in each of the cities where someone will say something to me about their experience of one of the earlier books, because it's too early for The Feral Detective to be anything but a kind of commercial for itself. But they'll say, I always felt X about, did you really mean such and such? And I'll remember myself, and they'll be connected to me, and we'll be connected differently. And so these encounters that I'll have, you know, it's very Philip K. Dick, you know, revelation always comes, God's voice will be expressed in the form of some words. Sorry, I'm going to have to ignore this call now. Let me turn off the ringer. In the form of some garbage bubblegum wrapper stuck to the bottom of your shoe, or to something you'll glimpse in an advertisement. You know, Ubik is sold as an underarm deodorant. And the transcendence of art is hidden inside the garbage of the art realm, you know? So when I come to someone's bookstore in their town, they're suspicious. You know, they're being sold something and they know it.
Right.
But inside that garbage environment, I mean, I'm not saying anything against bookstores and booksellers who are usually heroic to me, but still the whole enterprise of me being put on a plane at the exact right moment when the book is in the stores and being advertised, it's a very suspicious container. It's a deodorant can, but that person who shows up, they and I might spray a little bit of Ubik on one another at that moment, you know.
So you're undercover as a novelist.
I'm really a being, exactly. Yeah, and I'm constantly trying to tear holes in the novelist suit and just let you see that the human being is underneath, just hoping to meet you. Except if I meet too many of you, I'll freak out.
Run so back I also to have man cave.
Very yeah. compassionate to myself and only do very small amounts of meeting you.
Yeah. So in the piece you just quoted, towards the end of that piece, you quoted the thing. It's interesting the way that you reframed what I'd said as more challenging than I'd meant it to be about triangulating against the industrial entertainment complex. But anyway, the paragraph after that is the closing paragraph, and it's the one that they've chosen at Conatus to put, you know, to reprint at the top of the piece as if it, mm-hmm. you know, it's the highlighted thing. And that was actually one that I didn't get to in our last talk, because I was going to ask if it felt presumptuous of this, you know, if I was projecting this onto your work. But it seems to have come into its own context during this conversation, and it is what happens to a work of art when its most deeply felt hidden message is that art is no longer an adequate response to reality. So how do you feel about that sentence as being written about a feral detective?
Well, it's funny because I think you're ahead of me. I don't feel that as a obvious interpretation of feral detective, but you're ahead of me in a way that's both therefore perplexing and gives me a kind of encouragement, because I think the next book I'm writing has that as its subject, actually. It's all about suspicion of stories, this right. next book I'm writing.
Oh, great.
It's about trying to kill the storyteller for fucking us up.
So Harry Carey by the pen.
Yeah. And, you know, so that you see it already coming as a way in which the feral detective is attempting to query itself but falling short, not getting all the way there, is mysterious to me, but suggests that maybe I'll satisfy you better with this next one, which I'm always hoping to do, Jason.
That's very ironic. So, but do you feel like, because I wasn't sure, I mean, maybe I was sure how I meant it when I wrote it, but after I'd written it, I wasn't sure how accurate it was or how I meant it. But I feel as though in this conversation, we've kind of zeroed in on maybe why that sentence could be meaningful, but encouraging rather than discouraging, which is that art, it's not about getting into Valhalla. It's not about creating these wonderful products that will outlast us. It's about communication.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the moment.
In the
which
moment.
Is why, which is why the posterity dodge is such a distracting thing, because it's really a, I mean, here I've said I want this to be a used book, not a new book, which seems to cut against the idea of in the moment. And this happens to be a book with some, you know, frisson of immediacy, right, with the election and so forth. But what I mean is in the existential moment between the author and the reader at the moment of reading, which for me has always been an existential moment that's most freed from clutter and noise and the signal in the used bookstore with the out of print. So that's why I fantasize about it.
Because that was your formative. Those are your formative years.
Yeah. So that's a very good description. In the moment, but that does not have to do with the, you know, what of course my publisher dreams, which is that everyone buys it on the same day. We have our bestseller and we can move on.
That's
it's not
the
about
count.
The moment being November 6th. It's about the moment being that moment between you and I when our minds are occupying the same skull because you're reading the book.
The holy moment.
The holy moment, yeah.
Yeah, so in fact, that other thing is the counterfeit of that. It was November the 8th, by the way. You even forgot the date. But yeah, trying to capture it in amber as this historical moment when history's just another story anyway. Once it ends, everyone will forget it.
I think we're culminating. It's an earthquake drill that turned into a real earthquake.
Well, let's hope not.
We better evacuate.
I hear a voice that's not my own. Tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening to these words. I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen. It's hard to tell which thoughts are my own when I keep hearing everyone else. I keep hearing everyone else. I won't listen anymore. I won't listen anymore. These words, these words are yours. These words. When you are born, everything you are told becomes you without your choice. Some point they become the family of one that speaks with only one voice. Speak with only.